areas that we're trying to see ASA expand into is focusing a little bit more on science and technology and service of the poor. Obviously, faith and science questions are very important to many of us, but I think there are other important topics as well. And as a matter of Christian stewardship, I think that people who work in science and engineering have a unique opportunity, if they give careful thought to it, to make a big difference in the world through their profession, not just what they can do through their church or maybe through giving to adopt orphans or other things, all of which I've done in the past and only more recently got involved in the last few years in working on things. And I think we'll ultimately have a much bigger difference than all the money I've ever given to help foreign people in developing countries. So that's probably because when you're a college professor, you have more opportunities through research than you do through writing checks, right? So given the financial resources. Our first speaker is here from Messiah College. Her name is Barbara Riesler. She just received tenure in the Department of Engineering at Messiah. She got her bachelor's degree at Northwestern in a suburb of Chicago, right? I don't remember what the name of it, Evanston? Yes. Mm-hmm. And then got her PhD in at MIT in both schools. She was working primarily in biomedical engineering, and so she's very, very well able to use that training to help with people who particularly have disabilities or other kinds of issues in developing countries. So let's welcome her and look forward to hearing her presentation on work she's been doing at Messiah that actually is impacting people in Africa. Okay?
All right, I'm going to keep track of myself here, make sure I don't go over. I'm happy to see more than three people in the room today. When I told one of my colleagues that I was presenting at ASA on appropriate technology, he goes, "They do that there?" And I said, "Well, I guess they're trying to." So Walter actually invited my boss, Dr. Norman, to come give a presentation, and since he couldn't, I'm coming to present for Ray, and also Walter gave me the opportunity to present on my own work, too. So we are doing appropriate medical technology projects in Macha, Zambia, and I'm going to tell you about one of them today. I wasn't quite sure how to approach this kind of presentation, so I thought maybe the bent I would take is there are some of you in this audience who really don't know what appropriate technology is. Some of you might be thinking about starting up your own appropriate technology kinds of projects and don't know where to begin. Or maybe you already do this and you want to see how other people do it at other places. So I'm just going to tell you about how I got started. I started this from scratch 2 years ago, and I'll tell you where we're at now, and I'll tell you a few of the mistakes and lessons that I've learned, and maybe if you decide to take the plunge, you will avoid some of the mistakes that I made doing this project. So maybe some of you know where Messiah College is. We are a small program, but small programs can do big things. So if you're listening to, you'll hear from Walter Bradley about his multi-million dollar projects he has going on, and I get rather intimidated by that, and you don't have to be a multi-million dollar grant receiver to do what you want to do. So we are small, and we don't get multi-million dollar grants. We have 8 full-time faculty in the engineering department and roughly 170 students, so you don't have to be big to do the kinds of things we do. We also are ABET accredited, by the way, so we have a well-established engineering program. All the students at Messiah get a Bachelor of Science in Engineering degree, and then they have concentrations instead of straight-up mechanical engineering major, let's say. So I just started the biomedical concentration a few years ago. I've had a grand total of 3 students graduate from this with this concentration so far, and I have 5 students that will be working on this project. So that'll give you an idea about the size that it takes to do this kind of program. One of the great things we have at Messiah is called the Collaboratory for Strategic Partnerships and Applied Research, or just the Collaboratory for short. And you'll be hearing a little bit more about the Collaboratory in my next talk, too. It is a large student-led service learning organization at Messiah. It's driven primarily by the engineering students, but there are a lot of other students from other disciplines, too, that volunteer. And the Collaboratory has great resources and provides a lot of support for appropriate technology projects such as mine. If you're curious as to what kind of resources and documentation they provide, you can go on the webpage and you can look at all the information that the Collaboratory has on how to do projects like this. If you're biomedical engineering, you could also go to the Engineering World Health Organization. at Duke University to see how they do biomedical engineering at hospitals in the developing world. And then also the EPICS program at Purdue University has some great information and great documentation to help you get started. And we use a lot of EPICS materials in our own program. So those are just some resources you might have if you're curious about this and maybe want to go further at your own institution. So here I am with this brand new concentration. I have the power of the collaboratory behind me, and I want to find new projects. How do I get started? Well, fortunately at MSI, and probably at your institution too, we have a lot of contacts with a lot of people doing fabulous things all over the world. And so I contacted Dr. Tuma, and I said, I'm hopping on a plane to come visit you for a few days. I scraped together a few $1,000s, and I want to go see if there's any way I can help you and what you do in Zambia. So Macha Zambia is a small village located just outside South Central Zambia. So Dr. and Mrs. Tuma graciously put me up for a few days and said, go ahead, explore, and see what we have to do at Macha. So I, Macha has two main organizations, if you will, doing the great work that they do there. The first is Macha Mission Hospital that was founded by Dr. Tuma's father, Dr. Alvin Tuma. It's a 208-bed open ward hospital. Has some equipment that you would typically find in a Western hospital, but mainly their powers and their fabulous doctors and their diagnostic abilities to treat people there. And the other arm at Macha is the Malaria Institute at Macha. This is a branch of the Malaria Research Institute of Johns Hopkins University, particularly their Bloomberg School of Public Health. And so they have actually a very impressive set of labs there to do molecular biology, malaria research, tuberculosis research, HIV/AIDS, clinical labs. They're quite well equipped, and it's quite surprising to find something like that in a village like Macha. So, Johns Hopkins, Messiah College, kind of a bit of a difference there. What could I do? So, I thought, well, the only way I can find out what I can do is to just start interviewing potential clients. And so I spent 2 days just talking to people. What do you do, and is there anything that maybe a handful of undergraduate engineering students could do to help you out? Is there something you're not doing that maybe we could possibly help you out with? And for the first couple of days, I was actually quite discouraged. I couldn't find anything, particularly in the research side of things, in the laboratory part. And that's kind of more what I was looking for, to be honest. But the more I interviewed the physicians, particularly Dr. Tuma, I came to realize that they really needed help with their medical technology. The equipment that they had imported, if you will, just didn't last very long. It needed repair. Could we help in that aspect? And one particular piece of technology that wasn't working very well was their oxygen concentrators. And Dr. Tuma says they're failing too soon. We're missing out on this crucial respiratory therapy for these people. Can you maybe make them last longer and help them function better? So I went back to my students and I said, okay, we've got this project. Let's figure out what oxygen concentrators do and what could be going wrong. So I'll tell you a little bit about them. Now I'm going to get a little bit more technical. Not much, though, I promise. Oxygen concentrators are used instead of bottled oxygen. So if you see oxygen being given to patients in a hospital, it's usually piped in through a giant tank, right? But if you go visit grandma in the nursing home and she needs oxygen therapy when she's sleeping at night, maybe this is what she has by her bedside. And using bottled oxygen in Zambia is just not possible because they have no way of getting the tanks back and forth in time to deliver what they need. So what oxygen concentrators do is they take in room air, which is, if you remember from your chemistry class, 78% nitrogen and about 21% oxygen. And then the machine pretty much removes the nitrogen and gives back a high concentration of oxygen to the patient. If you were to purchase this DeVilbiss 5-liter compact concentrator here in the States, you might pay about $500. You know, not bad. But to get this device in Zambia, once they go through all the channels they need to go through, it sets them back around $3,000. And so they can't just go out and buy another one when it breaks. They need to keep it going. So the way Zambia uses their, or the way Macha uses their oxygen concentrators, they have three of them that they thought still worked. Two of them they wheeled around the wards as they needed them, and then one was permanently ensconced in the operating room and never left. And the people who usually get the oxygen therapy are very young children, particularly in the wintertime. They catch a bad cold, and it progresses worse to become something called bronchiolitis, and their lungs get clogged with mucus, and because they're so small, they can't clear the mucus, and they could basically suffocate, kind of like when you've had pneumonia, unless they got oxygen therapy to tide them over until their body has a chance to fight off the virus. So very crucial piece of equipment, and we need to make sure that we have this working. So why aren't they working? That's what we needed to figure out. So I'll tell you first how concentrators work and then the different spots where they could be failing. So the air is taken in through particle filters. The first particle filter is like the kind that are on the back of your hair dryers, you know, those black coarse filters. Then it goes through a HEPA filter. Then it's compressed and sent through the sieve beds down here, the zeolite filters. The sieve beds are just aluminum cylinders that are filled with this mineral called zeolite. Looks kind of like kitty litter. It's gray and kind of clay-like. And the pores in the zeolite trap the nitrogen and let the oxygen pass through, where it's stored in the reservoir and then delivered to the patient. So a lot of things could be going wrong in this chain of events. Dr. Tuma's hypothesis is that Zambia doesn't have a really reliable power supply. We have brownouts, and it takes a while to get the generator back up. So maybe this fluctuating power supply is causing the compressor to fail, and that's why the concentrators aren't working. Another possibility could just be the dust, the heat, and the humidity are clogging the filters or the sieve beds. We also didn't know if the oxygen concentrators were being maintained properly, and we also didn't know if they were perhaps older than they thought they were. You know how time kind of gets away from you, and I thought I just replaced the tires on my car. And so we didn't know if that could have been the case, too. So I was told about the project, but I didn't get to see any of this. They just said, could you help us? So the first year, we were pretty much flying blind. We didn't really know what was going on. So we focused on establishing our client relationship, particularly with Dr. Tuma, and he could actually come to the States once in a while and meet with us. And the students also spent a lot of time in the library just trying to learn about how... I'm sorry. The students put a lot of time on Google trying to figure out how concentrators work. And so they did their research. And then we also made sure we looked for expert advice, and you should do the same if you ever decide to do this because it's very helpful. It turned out that the manufacturer of the concentrators that are used in Matcha were just 2 hours down the turnpike from us. So we hopped in the car and went over there, and they showed us their plant and how they were made. And most importantly, they showed us how to take them apart and diagnose each part so that we could figure out what was going wrong. So armed with this information, two of my students went to Matcha without me. They went with another group, but I didn't go. To Matcha to spend 3 weeks to, among other things, analyze these concentrators. So they checked the make and the model to see how old they were. They checked to make sure the power requirements were matched to the grid in Zambia, that the current and the voltage were correct. And they checked the compressor function and checked the pressure release valve. They measured the pressures throughout the device to make sure all the different parts were at the right pressure. And then finally, they measured the oxygen output coming out. So I don't want to bog you down with too many details, but they looked at the three concentrators that they thought were working, two that were in the wards and one that was in the operating room. Power supply wasn't an issue. The voltage and the current all matched fine. The compressors seemed to be working fine. But the only concentrator that was still working was the one that was ensconced in the operating room, and the two in the wards really weren't doing anything at all. But they were not working for different reasons, which I'll talk about in a second. So the voltage and current were not the issue. The concentrators were older than we thought. You can't buy any of those three models anymore that I just showed you on the previous screen. But what was interesting was the oldest one, the one that the people at DeVilbiss couldn't believe was still working, was the one that was working the best. So there's something else there that's going on. So one of the concentrators in the ward had a leak in there. It had too low pressure. That's why it wasn't working. And then the one that had the high pressures in it with the low output meant that the sieve beds were likely to be clogged. It wasn't necessarily the filters or the compressor, but those silver beds filled with that zeolite material. We also noticed there wasn't much maintenance, dusty and dirty filters. Some of them were ripped out and not replaced. There just wasn't much maintenance going on. So probably the lack of maintenance plus the open wards with the dust and humidity was probably what's causing the problem. The last little somewhat interesting story, after the students came back, they heard that somebody walked off with one of the power cords to the oxygen concentrators, and that kind of limits functional capability of it too. So I thought that was interesting, actually, because here's a design aspect that is considered a bonus in perhaps a Western hospital that has flexibility to remove the power cords, and there it was a bad idea. So we needed something a little different there. Some other things we came to realize were that even though Dr. Tuma is a wonderful man and he was great to get us started and a great contact, he wasn't our best client. He wasn't involved enough in the day-to-day operation of the hospital, so we found some new clients, and that was very helpful for us to have someone more involved with the hospital operations. The staff that were in charge of the concentrators are very well trained. They knew how to take them apart, put them back together, do everything they needed to do, but they just didn't do the maintenance. And for whatever reason, just wasn't done. So our physician client said, look, you need to work around this. Please make these last longer in spite of ourselves and in spite of the operating conditions. And so that's what we set out to do for the second year when the students came back. We sent two new SIF beds over with Dr. Tuma, and the hospital maintenance workers replaced them and restored function. So that was a good hint that we were on the right path. We also delivered them a replacement power cord so that it would work. And the students decided to focus on the dust because they thought the heat and the humidity were within the acceptable ranges. So the students said, we're going to test the filters. Are we going to find any that have more capacity than what we already have? They thought dust was the problem. And lastly, we wanted to sign a non-disclosure agreement with DeVilbiss so that we can talk openly with them, have any intellectual property that could come out of this protected, and could we perhaps work with them to design some sort of a low-frills concentrator for a market like this. So the second year actually didn't go very well. I don't know if any of you manage student design projects at your own school, but they're really hard to do, and I think part of the reason why we became academics is because we weren't project managers, maybe. And so I found that that was, you know, it has been difficult, and this is difficult again. The students did spend an entire year rigging up a filter testing device. Didn't really work. That was kind of disappointing. Our non-disclosure agreement with DeVilbiss came too little too late once I finally got it going, and you know how it is, waiting for the VP to sign the darn thing. We met with them, and, oh, don't worry about the dust. HEPA filters will stop that. You should have been focusing on the humidity. Well, all right. So we're back to the drawing board next year, and we want to work on a new dehumidifier / filter addition to go on the outside of the concentrators to condition the air better. We'd also like to add a pressure sensor to shut off the concentrator before it gets too far gone, so we force the maintenance of it, and it won't work unless if they actually do replace the filters. And once, hopefully, my five glorious students will do this year, and we will go back and visit in May of 2013, test it out, also figure out more, get a better idea exactly why the concentrators are failing, and perhaps bring a few screws and permanently attach the power cords so that we won't have a problem with them walking off. So some of the lessons that I learned for this, client relationship is key. I think when you do research, you don't really have a client, but it's nice when you have a design project and you really do have a client. You have somebody who can say, no, I don't want that, I want this instead. I think that's a great experience for the students, and you really want to nurture that relationship, and it's very beneficial. I learned what was eye-opening to me was we're so used to designing for differences in resources. Cheap, cheap, cheap. Make it inexpensive. Use locally available materials. But I never thought about the idea of, well, they're not going to do maintenance, so you need to design around that. And to us, that sounds very odd. Why wouldn't you maintain these very expensive and valuable pieces of equipment But if they're too busy putting out other fires to do it, then you need to work around that. So you need to design for differences in the workplace environment too. If you're used to working with graduate students and decide to make opportunities for undergraduate students, just be prepared it's going to be different, but it's also very rewarding. It's a lot slower. Undergraduates tend to be overextended, involved in too many activities, and they have a hard time devoting their time to things like this. So be ready for that. And my last piece of advice to you is to just be bold. If you're thinking about trying this, I just scraped a little money together. I tried it, and it seemed to work. I think God opened a lot of doors for this kind of project. I do put a caveat around this, though. This was Western people working with other Western people on a Western piece of equipment, and so it was an easy fit. If you have a lot of other cross-cultural issues, being bold might do more harm than good. But for something like this, it actually worked. And so if you're in a situation like that that works, then go ahead and try it. I think you'll be amazed. So this is a list of all the fabulous people I worked with, and I think I'm at my 20 minutes, which means I can take questions. Before you get to listen to me again.
What about the use of computers and telecommunications between here and Zambia? Can you Skype with them and say, what do you think about this part, and so on and so forth? Is that a possibility?
You can. Their bandwidth is really small, so to do video is...